This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not. and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was among the first to cast his ballot in the capital, Tehran, and said the day of elections is a day for the Iranian people that will essentially determine the fate of the country for the coming years. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country needs to get fully prepared for confrontation with the U.S. in order to protect the dignity of the country. Also ahead, Israeli forces attack Palestinian protesters marching in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds against a controversial settlers' rally. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. We're going to kick off this bulletin with the latest updates on Iran's presidential election. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was among the first to cast his ballot in the capital, Tehran, and made some remarks. He said the day of elections is a day for the Iranian people that will essentially determine the fate of the country for the coming years. He says the day belongs to the people, the election belongs to the people, and the people's presence at the polling stations, those casting their ballots will determine their future for several years. He described it as a brave national test. The leader also called on voters to cast their ballots. Even a single vote is of importance, saying, "Don't think nothing is going to happen with just one vote. Every vote counts." And the leader said, as he noted, as he does always, highlights this point, that it's always better to vote as early as possible and not leave it late. More than 59 million people are eligible to cast their ballots in the country's 13th presidential election. The minimum voting age in Iran is 18. The opening and closing times for polling locations inside Iran are 7 a.m. to midnight and can be subjected to a two-hour extension. There will be 67,000 polling stations across Iran, as well as more than 230 in other countries for expatriate voters. Let's cross over to the Ministry of Interior, which plays an important role in the elections. Joining us from there is our correspondent, Yusuf Jalali. Yusuf, welcome. What can you tell us about what's going on at the Ministry of Interior and perhaps, you know, its role in the elections, the 13th presidential election in Iran?
Well, of course, the Interior Ministry is the beating heart of the Iranian election. It is, of course, tasked with monitoring the elections. Every single vote that is cast inside the ballot boxes is monitored and observed and seen from the Interior Ministry here. So Where I'm standing is the hall, the main hall of the Interior Ministry, where different officials come here, take to the podium and brief the reporters about the latest developments regarding the election here in Iran. So the polls opened at 7 a.m. local time here in Iran, and the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was among the first people who voted and cast their ballot inside the ballot boxes. So I also went there to that venue, to the polling station where the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution cast his ballot. And by casting his ballot, he conveys several messages. The leader conveys several messages. On top of them is his call for high turnout for the Islamic Republic, for the entire political system in Iran. High voter turnout is always a major issue. So that is why many Iranian officials, on top of them, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, also calling for high turnout in this election as well. So I was there, and he, of course, talked to reporters. The leader said that every single vote counts in this country. So he called for high voter participation, and he said that the Iranians should take part in the decision-making process by electing their presidents. As you know, since 4 decades ago, with the establishment of the Islamic Republic, Iran has been holding an average of one election every year. So, and even today, Iranians are not just participating in the presidential vote. They're taking part in four elections at the same time. They're taking part in the presidential vote, in the city and village council vote, the midterm parliamentary election, and the midterm assembly of experts election. So four elections concurrently are being held across the country. So the polls open at 7 a.m. local time here, and will end at 5 p.m. actually local time. And as of every year, as with every year, most probably the votes will be extended until 12 p.m. local time here. At the end of the day, 12 a.m. actually. So that is why we're expecting that this time around the voting hours will also be extended. And the fact that the elections are being held amid the coronavirus pandemic, different measures have been taken by the authorities, including extending the voting hours until 2 a.m. the following day. And this time, the start of the voting, of course, was an hour ahead of the previous election. So every round of the elections, in every round of the elections, we would see that the elections start at 8 a.m., but this time around it started at 7 a.m., 1 hour earlier. So, and different other measures are being taken by the authorities, including the fact that 30% of the capacities of the polling stations are going to be used for people to stand in queues and cast their ballots. And this time, stamps are not used in the election. So people, instead of the ordinary classical ways of authentication processes, online authentication processes are being used right now across the country. So to avoid touching the stamps and for the fingerprints and the authentication process. So this is a very different election, given the fact that this time it's not an election that is a competition between or rivalry between different political parties. This time around, it's a contest of plans. Those stand a better chance to win the election that have offered during their campaigns a better plan, a viable roadmap for fixing the Iranian economy. This time around, the focus of the election is not on the political parties. So in previous presidential elections, you would see that people are distracted by the fact that their favorite nominee or their favorite candidate has to be coming from their favorite, political party. But this time around, This is not the case. People want a change, a real economic change for their country. That is why they were, pursuing and seeking, of course, to find and choose a candidate among the seven candidates who are now only four candidates because three stepped out of the race. They want a candidate who can bring about a real change.
Great stuff, Yusuf. Thank you very much indeed. Yusuf Jalali there, our correspondent, joining us from the Ministry of Interior here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thanks a lot, Yusuf. Thank you. Now, it's not just Iranians in Iran that are casting their ballots. Iranian expats outside the country are also casting their ballots across the globe, from the United Kingdom to Lebanon to Afghanistan. And it's Afghanistan where we're going to go to now, the Afghan capital, Kabul, joined there by our correspondent, Amin Alami, for more on that. Amin, welcome. Tell us firstly where you are and what's the voter turnout there and what you're seeing, who have you spoken to as well?
Well, currently I'm at the Iranian embassy here in the Afghan capital, Kabul. As I talked to officials here at the Iranian embassy, dozens of Iranian citizens have so far came to this embassy and casted their ballots. As they say, the voting program is going to go on till 6 p.m. local time here. But in the meantime, given security threats are high, Afghan Interior Ministry have deployed a number of security forces around the embassy here in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Many routes are blocked, and only Iranian individuals or Iranian citizens are allowed to enter to Iranian embassy to cast their ballots. I also talked to Iranian ambassador here, Dr. Bahadur Aminyan. He widely welcomed the presence of Iranian citizens at the Iranian embassy for casting their ballots and said that they came here to support the democratic system in their country and support their own country, as well as he said that this move is to strengthen the unity of Iranian nation inside Iran as well as abroad, mainly here in the Afghan capital, Kabul. This is also worth mentioning that only the staff of Iranian embassy are not those who are attending, who are casting their ballots. Many other Iranians, including the workers of UN bodies and many other international organizations or NGOs who are stationed in Afghanistan, have come here in Kabul to cast their ballots. In the meantime, according to local sources in Jalalabad, the capital city of Eastern Nangarhar province of Afghanistan, many Iranian citizens, mainly the staff of the Iranian consulate in Jalalabad, have also come here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, to cast their ballots. In the meantime, many other Iranians will also cast their ballots in different areas of Afghanistan, mainly in the southern Kandahar province, western Herat, as well as in northern Mazar-e-Sharif, the capital city of Balkh province.
Okay, Amin, thank you very much indeed for that. Amin Alami there, our correspondent in the Afghan capital, Kabul, joining us from the Iranian embassy, where Iranian expats in Afghanistan are casting their ballots for the next president of the country. Now, Iran's chief negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, says talks on reviving the 2015 nuclear agreement have come closer than ever to fruition. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Araghchi noted that some essential issues are still being negotiated. He said Tehran wants to make sure that the United States will not repeat its unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal with Iran. The Kremlin says Russian President Vladimir Putin has told his U.S. counterpart that he expects Washington to fully return to the accord known as the JCPOA. Iran, along with the European Union and six world powers, thrashed out the landmark agreement in 2015 after years of negotiations. However, the U.S. pulled out of the deal in 2018, reimposing sanctions on Iran. Tehran says it wants all sanctions removed in a verifiable manner. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country needs to prepare for both dialogue and confrontation with the United States under President Joe Biden. In remarks during the meeting of the ruling Workers' Party, Kim outlined his strategy for relations with Washington. He stressed that Pyongyang needs to get fully prepared for confrontation in order to protect the dignity of the country. North Korea has already accused the Biden of pursuing a, quote, hostile policy. Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, made headlines but little diplomatic progress with a series of face-to-face meetings with Kim. Biden says he will not pursue that policy unless North Korea negotiates its nuclear arsenal with a concrete plan. Israeli forces attacked Palestinian protesters in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, arresting a number of people. Palestinians were protesting outside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound against a controversial march by Israeli settlers on Tuesday. During the march, Israeli settlers insulted Islam's Prophet Muhammad and chanted death to Arabs under the protection of Israeli forces. The so-called March of Flag also triggered protests in the Gaza Strip, where resistance groups warned the regime of consequences for allowing such a controversial move. Israel, meanwhile, has carried out airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip, hitting at least 10 Palestinian targets near the cities of Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun. No casualties have been reported so far. Tel Aviv claims the air raids were in response to Palestinians sending incendiary balloons towards the occupied territories. Also, Palestinian resistance groups have shot down and seized an Israeli drone in the west of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli strikes followed Israel's 11-day aggression against Gaza last month. The conflict ended on May 21st after a ceasefire. Nearly 260 Palestinians, half of them women and children, were killed. Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel in response, killing a dozen people. Earlier, we were joined by Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent in Gaza, who gave us an update on the latest round of Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip.
Israeli fighter jets attacked at least 10 security posts that belong to Hamas's military wing, the Ibn Qassam Brigades, over the past few hours. The attacks targeted the northern Gaza Strip towns of Beit Lahia, Jabalia, and Beit Hanun. And also Israeli warplanes attacked at least one security post in the south of Gaza City, as well as in the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance factions fired their heavy machine guns towards Israeli drones and also towards areas in the east of the enclave, prompting the Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile interception system to be launched, basically proving that this missile interception system is a failure, as it was triggered by machine gun fire from the Gaza Strip.
The UK reports over 11,000 new COVID-19 infections, its highest daily rise in cases in nearly 4 months. Official figures show the number of new deaths has also risen to 19 from 9, reported on Wednesday. The government on Monday announced a decision to delay the lifting of restrictions due to the spread of the new Delta strain first detected in India. Experts are concerned that rising case numbers will turn into death tolls similar to previous waves. A government report published on Thursday warned that cases are rising exponentially across England, driven by mostly unvaccinated age groups. Britain has suffered Europe's highest coronavirus death toll of around 128,000 lives. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Licensed civilian gun bearers in occupied Palestine, predominantly Jewish men, are openly encouraged by the Zionist regime to shoot to kill alleged or perceived Palestinian people. On the night of May 16th, Jewish shooters reportedly arrived in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Shafat in four cars, opened fire on Palestinian residents, and injured two, says Rella Mazzali, writer, in an article titled Israeli Gun Owners Are Licensed by Zionist Regime to Kill Palestinians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Zionist regime's bombing has stopped, at least for now. But we need to talk about guns as well as bombs and neighborhoods as well as territories. Indeed, the Israeli regime's small arms policies and its war policies are directly and indirectly linked. Licensed civilian gun bearers in occupied Palestine, predominantly Jewish men, are openly encouraged by the Zionist regime to shoot to kill alleged or perceived Palestinian people. On the night of May 16th, Jewish shooters reportedly arrived in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Shafat in four cars, opened fire on Palestinian residents, and injured two. Tellingly, reports noted that the shooters were licensed gun bearers. A week earlier, Jewish men shot and killed 32-year-old Musa Hassuna from dozens of meters away, near his home in Lod, inside the occupied Palestine. A demand for their release from police custody, where they were held for interrogation, was tweeted the next day by the Zionist regime's public security minister, who lauded the shooters as licensed gun carriers. In recent years, the Israeli regime's policies on small arms have taken an ominous, aggressive turn. The current sharp spike in license applications is a direct result of these policies, as well as a response to the recent eruption of violence. According to data obtained by Gun Free Kitchen Tables, GFKT, a coalition of civil society organizations aiming to disarm homes and streets and to tighten gun controls, in the past 5 years, gun licensing authorities have issued more than 100,000 new civilian licenses. This trend has been strongly protested by the coalition, which has also contested it in the Zionist regime Supreme Court. New data on shootings of women in the occupied Palestine already seems to reflect the lethal results of the regime's policies. In 2020, the number of women shot dead with a licensed gun in the occupied Palestine was 2.5 times the average number of female gun victims in the preceding 4 years combined. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime police have been over and under policing Palestinian cities and towns inside the occupied Palestine for decades. They have made disproportionate numbers of often arbitrary arrests, while knowingly enabling the stockpiling of unlicensed firearms. According to GFKT's research, these are mostly procured from military and other licensed sources, and they increasingly arm criminal groups. Nearly 100 Palestinian citizens were killed in 2020, mostly with guns, far outnumbering Jewish casualties in the same period, though the community forms just 20% of the population. For more than a decade, Palestinian leaders have been pleading with the Israeli regime's officials to stem the flow of arms into their communities. The regime has done nothing. No ministers will be demanding the release of the detained Palestinians, certainly not the public security minister who is in charge of the police. Police will not duplicate the kind of support they provide for attacks by the right-wing groups whom they give full access to Palestinian neighborhoods without intervening. During 1 week of the unrest in May, the Zionist regime police reportedly arrested 850 Palestinian citizens of the occupied Palestine compared with 150 Jews. At the same time, there are great attention-grabbing ploys to sidestep the failing governance of those in power. This is precisely the same algorithm that has gilded the Zionist regime's war policies. This fake regime appears to have zero interest in reducing violence or preserving lives, especially not Palestinian lives. Supremacy and expansion, and above all, clinging to power, Trump leaves and blocks any possible moves towards negotiated political solutions. The only solutions envisioned are force, bombs, and guns. This is why the fake regime of Israel is fast unraveling.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou alone, who has no associate nor any equal. And thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In parallel with the continuous Israeli attacks in the occupied city of Al-Quds and further attempts by members of religious Zionist extremists to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, warned in a message to the leaders of the occupation and its settlers of the consequences of such bigotry. Meanwhile, Benjamin Netanyahu incurred the biggest loss in his political history, which will be enough to end the man's 12 continuous years as prime minister. Thus, the winds of change are gusting within the Zionist regime after a cycle of early elections that lasted the internal crisis for nearly 2.5 years. These changes, however, will not touch the apartheid policies, not only because the new prime minister is one of the most prominent faces of the extreme right, but also because this new governmental coalition will have to keep pace with settler opinion, for which the right wing has become part of its identity. The obstacles to forming the new Israeli government fell one after the other, where the new government scored the needed confidence votes on Sunday. the government of Yamina party leader Naftali Bennett was born, while Benjamin Netanyahu headed to the opposition seats in the Knesset to fight for his political and personal fate within his party and in court, which he worked hard to bypass, yet eventually failed. However, as the new government won confidence, Netanyahu is expected to face a different reality that may bring down his long-term hopes, even if he succeeds in deterring the rebellion against him within his own party or bypassing his trial. As part of the new coalition's understandings, it was agreed to move forward with amending the basic law of the Knesset with the aim of preventing Netanyahu from running in the upcoming elections. Meanwhile, perhaps one of the most important repercussions of the Palestinian Intifada was the Battle of the Sword of Al-Quds, which threw a ball of flame into the lap of Fatah movement in the occupied territories. Because of Mahmoud Abbas's leadership, the movement failed to keep pace with the Intifada and the war as it befits it, knowing that many members of Fatah have contributed by their own initiative to the uprisings in the West Bank. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. There is no doubt that the latest round of confrontation witnessed in occupied Palestine, which was expressed by both stones and missiles, was linked to the acceleration of the Zionist ethnic cleansing process in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in particular. However, a new catalyst that is expected to bring about new challenges for the Israeli entity is the dismissal of Benjamin Netanyahu's regime, which is heading towards incurring the biggest loss in its political history. A loss that will not be limited to Netanyahu facing jail time, but may also extend to the leadership of the Likud party and perhaps to its future in the entire Israeli arena. To discuss this issue with us from the West Bank is Dr. Saad Nimr, academic at Beer Zeit University. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nimr. Now, the occupation's Knesset on Sunday approved a new right, Naftali Bennett, as prime minister, and the new cabinet was sworn in a wave of anger and chaos inside the Knesset. What happened on Sunday inside that Knesset was definitely unprecedented, where Netanyahu gave a firing speech against Bennett, and Bennett was trying to defend himself, and Netanyahu was expecting that this government will fail, and it will fail soon. Will Bennett be able to overcome this internal Zionist challenges that Netanyahu put forward, basically on Bennett's first day?
It's quite clear that Netanyahu was trying as much as he could to make this government fail. He couldn't by the end of the day, but he tried all the way till even we thought that at some time he might do some crazy thing even in the West Bank or in Gaza in order to sabotage the voting over this government. However, he tried, but he failed because he knew that it's either a seat, either the prime minister seat in the Israeli government or a seat in the prison. And that's what he's going to go to anyway, to a seat in the prison. Now, he tried to sabotage, as I said, the government of Bennett, but it didn't work. And narrowly, Bennett managed to get the vote on the government, though there is a coalition of eight parties, or let me say seven, and the support of the Arab party, Arab group, to support this government, but still, it is a very narrow government. Now, the challenges are huge in front of this government. First of all, the challenge of continuing for more than 2 months, at least. Mm-hmm. The problem is with this government, from the very beginning, Bennett and Lapid, Saab, and Gantz, and the Likud party, they knew that there is no chemistry between all of them. But the whole problem was that we need this government only to bring Netanyahu down, and that's what they did. Now, since it is very narrow, it's only 61 votes in the Knesset, means that in any time Netanyahu managed in the coming few weeks to convince even one or two of the people who are supporting this government to back up and to not to vote for them in any next voting for confidence, definitely this government will fail. And in this case, Israel is going for the fifth election within 2 years. The whole idea was for this coalition is to, as I said, to fail Netanyahu and to bring him down from the prime minister position.
But Dr. Nimmer, we did see that Israel is entering a new phase after a ruling for a long time was confined only to Benjamin Netanyahu. As you are saying, you're saying that this coalition had one goal and is to bring Netanyahu out of the regime. But the change of prime minister is the most important thing at this stage in Zionist politics. However, does the fall of Netanyahu mean the fall of Israeli right-wing Zionists?
No, not really, because, you know, in the last four elections, what was going on that the right wing was competing with the right wing. So both of them are, right wing. Remember that Bennett was member of the Likud with Netanyahu, and he split it and he formed his own coalition. Now, the whole thing is that will be no difference in the politics generally. We can see that from the last Sunday speeches. By Netanyahu and by Bennett. Bennett said quite clearly that we are committed to the settlements. We are going to go ahead with the plans for the settlements. We are not going to let Iran go ahead with the nuclear weapon from his point of view. And as well, we are going to keep a very close monitoring of sea area, which is the area in the West Bank, consists of around 60% of the West Bank, which Israel is trying to annex it to Israel officially. So in terms of politics, for the Palestinians at least, Bennett-Lapid government have no difference whatsoever from the one of Netanyahu. The only difference is maybe there will be some problems within the government if he announces settlements in a very clear way, because in this case, we believe that maybe Meretz, which consider itself a Zionist left, and maybe the Labour Party would object to that, and that will bring the government back again to a failure in the coming few weeks or maximum 2 months time. Because of that, but there will be no difference in the politics, and there is no change in the Israeli politics in general in the after this government. Both governments, the Netanyahu one and this new one, are going on the same track. They are both two faces for the same coin. So it's it has nothing to do with the Palestinians. Even the Americans, when they are trying to congratulate Bennett for his government, now they will try to say, okay, give it time, and we will see how it's going to do its conduct in the politics, and hoping that we can bring back the Palestinians and Israeli together into negotiations. Bennett made it very clear that he's not going to negotiate. He's make it very clear that he's not going to give anything to the Palestinians, nor he would allow a Palestinian state, exactly in the same lines of Netanyahu. So I don't think that this government will make any change for the overall picture in the area.
Dr. Saad, the wind of change are creating new challenges for the Israeli entity, whether internally where this crisis has been going on for the past 2.5 years, or whether on the Palestinian scene, because a new challenge has emerged that Netanyahu maybe never faced or faced with a minimal effect, but Bennett is now going to face a new wave of Palestinian revolution against the occupation. How do you think he will be able to handle the harmony between the resistance in Gaza and also the resistance revived by the youth of Palestine in Al-Quds, in West Bank, in the 1948 territories?
Well, we should not wait very long anyway. Tomorrow it will be the first examination on that government and on what's going on. Because the Israeli, when they postponed earlier the march, the flag march for the settlers inside
Jerusalem. Which was supposed to happen Tuesday, June 15.
Yes, when they postpone it now, Netanyahu in the last few days, he gave orders for this march to go ahead in an attempt also to sabotage the government of Bennett. Now, Bennett had to face tomorrow what was going on. The Palestinians are very alerted. They are very aware of what's going on. So we expect tomorrow there will be a clashes in Jerusalem, and it will be hard one. At the same time, most expectedly that in all the other cities and areas in the West Bank, there will be also clashes on the hotspots near the towns and the cities around the West Bank. So to what extent that would encourage Hamas to also participate, I don't know in this moment, But maybe we'll wait and see. But I think it's a little bit far to think of it as something possible now. But generally speaking, there will be, yes, a kind of a confrontation coming soon.
This brings about a very important notion. Dr. Nimr, a very important notion that brings about to the Palestinian scene is a shift in the balance of power, in the power of initiative, which is benefiting the Palestinian natives against the Zionist occupation. But in all of this scene, in 1 minute, do you think that the Oslo Agreement is still viable, it's still a reality inside of Palestine?
It depends on who's looking at it. From our point of view as people, Palestinian people in general, and the Palestinian resistance, definitely Oslo became the two-state solution is two-state illusion, and Oslo is dead. That's it. No more thinking even of it or going back to it in any way. Maybe the Palestinian authorities, backed by the Europeans, the Americans, they are still talking about, you know, two-state solution and Oslo agreement in a way or another, because they have no other alternative to that. If the European, for instance, said that the two-state solution failed, so what's next? What's the next step? What is the alternative? They have no alternative, and they don't want to think about, you know, one state or the idea that this colonial project called Israel, as a colonial racist apartheid regime, should be confronted not only by the Palestinians, but also by all the Arab, Islamic, as well as the international community.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Saad Nimr, academic at Birzeit University, talking to us about the shift of power inside of Palestine towards the Palestinian natives. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the developments inside of Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Parallel to the Omani delegation continuing its talks in Sana'a for the second week in a row, there were persistent American attempts to push towards the legalization of the presence of foreign forces in Yemeni lands and waters, and to even postpone talking about this presence indefinitely. This new condition angered Sana'a and embarrassed the Omanis. The efforts of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia to limit the talks to what falls under Ansarullah's control completely contradicts the principles of the resistance movement, which considers that engaging in any international endeavors that surpasses Yemeni independence is an illegal matter and unacceptable to be placed under negotiations. More in this following report.
As he prepared for departure from Sana'a with a delegation of the office of the Sultan of Oman on Friday, the spokesman of the Yemeni Ansarullah movement and the head of its negotiation delegation, Muhammad Abdus Salam, announced that the Omanis have been presented with the possible vision for ending the aggression and lifting the siege imposed on Yemen, beginning with securing the humanitarian operation. Abdus Salam pointed out that the meetings of the Omani delegation included the leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, head of the Supreme Political Council, the General Staff, the Coordination and Redeployment Committee in Hodeidah, and social and political figures from Ma'rib Governorate. Meanwhile, the Omani Foreign Minister Badr al-Busaidi arrived on Thursday in the Saudi capital Riyadh bearing a written message from Sultan Haytham bin Tariq to King Salman. The message appears to be related to the discussions held by the Omani royal delegation in Sana'a over a period of 5 days, whose indications suggested that a significant breakthrough has been achieved in the humanitarian file, perhaps paving the way for moving to other more complicated political files. Parallel to the Omani delegation's talks in Sana'a last week, there were persistent American attempts to push towards the legalization of the presence of foreign occupation forces in Yemeni lands and waters, and to postpone talking about this presence indefinitely, a new condition that angered Sana'a and embarrassed the Omanis. the Biden administration and Saudi Arabia attempted to limit the peace talks to confine the areas under Ansarullah's control, as the latter rejected these attempts since it completely contradicts the principles of the movement, which considers that engaging in any international endeavors that go beyond the ceiling of the Yemeni independence and sovereignty is an illegal matter. This was confirmed by the Supreme Political Council in Sana'a during its regular meeting last week, where it stressed that lifting the siege, stopping the aggression by air, land, and sea, ending the occupation, the exit of foreign forces, and non-interference in the internal affairs of Yemen are basic principles that cannot be deviated from in any future discussions.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Laith Maruf, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Laith, now we did see that the Omani foreign minister flew last week to Riyadh, and he had a written message from the Sultan of Oman, Sultan Haytham bin Tariq, to King Salman. And supposedly this message suggested a significant breakthrough that has been achieved concerning the Yemeni humanitarian condition. Do you think that this might be a way to pave the route for maybe going into political discussions that have been just stuck in stalemate since March 2015?
Unfortunately, I don't think so, and specifically because if you look at what the United States is attempting to do, which is to calm down as many conflicts that it's involved in and its vessels are involved in, so it can concentrate on war with China or Russia, the reality is the United States doesn't want to have peace with Iran, doesn't want to have peace with Syria or Yemen. Just like apartheid Israel doesn't want to have peace with the Palestinian people. They want to delay the confrontation, waste time on the resistance axis, pulling them into negotiations that are endless, as they did with the Palestinians for 30 years, while they concentrate on a more pressing confrontation points for them, like China and Russia. So it is in the interest of the resistance as a whole, including in Yemen, not to be pulled into this ridiculous scheme of negotiating forever.
Well, Laith, Ansarullah are still very doubtful concerning these talks, especially in the light of the continued American evasion, which recently took the form of an attempt to try and remove the issue of even talking about foreign occupation forces holding grounds inside of Yemen. They won't even, the Ansarullah not even talk about this matter. By the way, this is one of Ansarullah's big no-nos. They would never, and I mean never, accept such a condition. In that event, how do you think Saudi Arabia will react? Because we know that the Yemeni resistance will just stand its ground.
Well, look, the Saudis and the Americans behind them, as I said just before, they want to delay the confrontation, waste some time on the resistance axis. And obviously the leadership of the resistance in Yemen, Ansarullah, are smart enough after, you know, living through this war for 67 years now, and understand what is happening on the ground. Look, the apartheid Israel is taking over multiple islands on the Bab al-Mandeb strategic strait. The Emiratis are helping them colonize Socotra and other islands. This is an ongoing colonization, not even just war or occupation. It's ongoing colonization, and the only way to stop that is by defeating it militarily. And I believe the leadership in Ansarullah are smart enough to make that calculation.
Well, they did stress very much in the Supreme Political Council of Sana'a, which they meet on every week. They stressed that the lifting of the siege, the stopping of the aggression, the removal of the foreign occupation forces, also the non-interference in the internal affairs of Yemen, there are basic principles that they would not accept in any discussion. They have said that time and again. They even said that prior to the start of the war in March 2015, when then we were supposedly on the verge of having a breakthrough in the dialogue between Yemenis themselves and Mohammed bin Salman, or the power then decided to get involved in Yemen. But What are Ansarullah's options here if and when maybe these principles are not met? If Mohammed bin Salman and his American allies say, no, we won't accept it, the war continues.
The options that Ansarullah have, though, is to continue hitting the main targets, important infrastructure targets of Saudi-occupied Arabia. And in my opinion, they should expand the targeting to the United Arab Emirates because of the direct colonization of the Yemeni islands in collaboration with the apartheid Israel. And this is the only path forward. The resistance not only in Yemen but all across the region has to hit hard if the United States wants to withdraw from our region so it can concentrate on confronting China and Russia. That is actually the point, the most important moment for the resistance to hit the Americans and their vessels across the region. It is very important to recognize that even though the empire wants to withdraw, it doesn't really want to allow the resistance access to win anything. And we can see that in Palestine, for instance, and in this situation in Yemen. The vessels like Saudi-occupied Arabia are not willing to give one inch, because if they do, and this is the fear of the empire as a whole, if they give one inch to the resistance axis on any of the fronts, it will steamroll and cascade and snowball into total disaster for the empire and its vessels. So there is only an attempt to waste time and distract and delay the inevitable, which is a confrontation and an exit of the American occupying forces from the whole region.
Well, Laithi, Hadi government's position, if there is anything called the Hadi government, they are basically mercenaries, but they indicated that the Omani mediation is trying to move in a direction that does not appeal to the coalition, to the coalition aggression and the forces loyal to it on the ground in Yemen. Especially with regard to stopping the advances of Sana'a on Ma'rib governorate in the north on the border with Saudi Arabia. Why is Ma'rib causing such a paranoia for the Saudi regime that they are ready to break any framework for a comprehensive ceasefire, at least with the Yemeni resistance?
You know, look, if we look at the battlefield, the Yemeni resistance has been pushing through the mountain regions of Najran and Jizan, the originally Yemeni provinces that were occupied by the Saudis in the 1930s, and they are gaining grounds there. So you have to imagine if the resistance in Yemen managed to liberate Ma'rib, and then that's an open, you know, flatlands all the way to Riyadh from there. So it is actually a very weak point of defense for the Saudis. And this is on top of it, the fact that there is the huge oil and gas reserves that are there that could allow Yemen to be independent in its energy needs. And we have to calculate also how Oman and why Oman is rushing right now to pressure some of the other players in the Gulf region to calm down the situation in Yemen. And it is because it's actually spilling into Oman. You know, for the last couple of weeks, there's been constant demonstrations in Oman, in the western parts that are close to Yemen, and this is a spilling situation from the fact that you know, most of these tribes in western Oman are blood relatives of people in Yemen. And, you know, they can see what's happening across the region of retreat of American imperials and powers. And it's bringing back memories for the Omani authorities of the 1960s and 70s, when there was armed uprising, revolutions in Oman to dethrone the Sultan, and that is very close to the British at the time, and now is close to the Americans. So all of these are related to each other. It's one battle zone, geographic region of the world, and we have to always think about what is the interest of somebody like Oman to pressure now Saudi, and it's obvious it's connected to the troubles happening on the ground in Oman.
Definitely. It seems that there are going to be a very decisive couple of weeks to come for Yemen and for the region as well in the Arabian Peninsula. Thank you very much for being with us, Laith Maarouf from Beirut, political commentator, to talk about the latest developments in Yemen. Thank you. And please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
In the limelight.
Despite the growing necessity of transitioning to renewable energy, the share of fossil fuels in the world's total energy mix barely changed during a recent decade, according to a report released recently. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Share of Fossil Fuels in Global Energy Mix Has Not Moved by an Inch in a Decade. Stay tuned for more. Despite the growing necessity of transitioning to renewable energy, the share of fossil fuels in the world's total energy mix barely changed during a recent decade, according to a report released.